Hi, everyone. This is Raquel.
Hi, and this is Jennifer.
Welcome to Madness Cafe.
This is a feminist podcast where we talk about women's issues, politics, and health and wellness.
And where those issues intersect. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Madness Cafe. Today, Jennifer and I are joined by Corey Allen, who is a former Secret Service agent assigned to the Obamas and now special secret agent in charge. I hope I got that title right. I probably did not. I probably screwed that up, but we'll let Corey correct me. LGBTQ advocate, writer, and this is his current book. It's called Breaking Free, A Saga of Self-Discovery by a Gay Secret Service Agent. And just a little blurb from the back. It's a deeply personal yet candid saga of a gay Secret Service agent in the Obama era, an agent who was struggling with his own identity, marriage, discrimination, and balancing the demands that accompany being assigned to protect the most powerful people in the world. That's just a tiny little snippet. I hope that piques everybody's interest. But now we're joined by the lovely Corey Allen. Corey, thank you for being here.
Good morning, and thank you for having me on. That was arguably one of the best intros I've ever had. So thank you. That was fantastic.
Oh my gosh. Thank you. Oh,
pat on the back. Little kudos to Raquel. Well, I have to say, Corey, that I really, really enjoyed reading your book. Mm-hmm. So thank you for writing it, number one. And then if you could start by just giving us a little of your background, who you are, where you came from, and then how did you come to write this book?
Absolutely. Thank you, first and foremost, for picking it up and reading it and helping spread the messages that are contained in it. I grew up on the East Coast. I now live in California, in Pennsylvania and rural parts of both Pennsylvania and Virginia. We dealt with domestic violence growing up in the home for about a decade of my formidable years, if you will. And then those early interactions with law enforcement really helped shape my direction in life. And I ended up working for the same police agency that I had called on for help in helping protect mom and my little sister. And then once I finished my bachelor's degree, that led me into federal service. As you see, the book has now come out from that. But after about 10 years with the Secret Service, I had to do a hard life reset is really what it was. I'd been through a divorce and all kinds of other stuff. And I just needed a way to process all of that. And when I got to California, I was by myself, just me and my dog. And the book began as a note on my iPhone. And it was a way for me to process everything I'd been through. And it became hugely cathartic. And I was moments of just processing in tears and realizing that there's a whole lot of stuff underneath that I really needed to dig into. And so it helped flag all of that as I proceeded forward in life. And the pandemic hit. And I was like, well, I've got all this time. And I have this thing that I've written, why don't I try and do something with it? And then I had the time and energy and just kind of bumbled my way through the process, hiring an editor on my own and my own PR firm. And I handled all of that myself. It was a massive undertaking to get the book through. And now I'm here on the West Coast and now I'm supervisory position, engaged with a baby on the way, all kinds of great stuff happening.
That's so great. Can I just say, I really appreciate how candid you are in the book and the amount of self-reflection that you do in the book. Like, as you're telling about your life and, you know, your relationships, and then you'll throw in, yeah, missed that red flag, or, oh, I wasn't yet thinking about how this was affecting me, or I wasn't yet dealing with what these emotions were. And I really appreciate that you put that in the book. I thought that was very, that was very helpful and
human.
Yeah, I thought it was very human. And yet so many of us don't take the time to be that self-reflective. So I just wanted to, you know, say kudos to you for that.
Thank you. When I started writing it, and I'm not a writer by trade. That's just not what I do. I'm a knuckle dragger, as I call myself. but it was the only way I knew how to write and to be honest with myself of like, I didn't have a therapist at the time, and this was becoming that vehicle for me to make sure that when I met my now fiance, that I don't repeat past mistakes or errors, that I present my true authentic self. But although there was a lot of fear in the vulnerability aspect of putting all this out there, and is this going to tank my career? Is when mom reads this, is she going to, because she didn't know about me being in an open marriage and the faults within that. So it was very terrifying as well of really putting it all out there. But as you said, the candidness and the vulnerability is really what has resonated, and people connect with that. Mm-hmm. Or regardless of your sexuality or whatever, we can all relate to stuff like that. And yeah, that's been amazing to see that that's been the product.
Well, since you did bring it up, how have people like your mother, your job, your coworkers, friends, how have they reacted to the material in the book?
Overwhelmingly positive.
Good.
I've been promoted twice since the book came out, and that wasn't because of the book. It's because hopefully I'm doing a great job.
Congratulations.
So mom is my number one fan, which it's
good
amazing.
Mom.
Yeah, she's an amazing human being. But it's been overwhelmingly positive, and to have people come out and people like Katie Couric weigh in and thank me for being so candid and telling my story and my journey. So I get those nods of appreciation. It's like, yeah, no, we're good. It was definitely all worth the risk, if you will.
That's so awesome. Amazing. What does the title Breaking Free mean to you?
That wasn't the original title. Breaking free from societal norms and expectations. It was really where that began. I didn't know how else to encapsulate what I was striving to do when I left the Secret Service, and I loved my job and my peers and my colleagues, and I was with the Obamas. Like, I was loving it, and I did not take that lightly when I had to do that hard life reset, but I just had to break free from so many things to find my true self and live authentically. So that's really where that came from. It wasn't the original title of the book, because there's a lot of other books called Breaking Free, but only one like mine.
Well, what was the original title? Now we need to know.
Yeah, I need to know too.
It was originally going to be Phase 2, which, mm-hmm, again, that's an agency-specific term, so nobody would have known what that really meant unless you had worked for the Secret Service, and that was the second, mm-hmm, part of your career. Mm-hmm. Me, I was like, okay, well, this is the second part of my life.
So cool.
But then it wouldn't have resonated with the broader audience.
I like it.
I like it too.
It would have resonated with us, so anywho.
I'm on phase, no, I think I'm moving into phase 4, maybe.
I don't know. I don't know what phase I'm in.
Yeah.
Cool. I don't either anymore, honestly.
Well, I really like that you bring that up, that there's, you know, different phases in your life. And you talk in the book about when the shooting at the Pulse nightclub happened in Florida, that you felt like you needed to do something. Right. And so you ran the marathon and you started fundraising and doing everything involved with that. Is that part of what has pushed you into being now, in addition to all of the other things that you do, of being an advocate for LGBTQ+ community?
It's incumbent on me that if I now have a voice and I have a growing platform, that I use that for other people. You always reach back and pull up others with you as you go.
Yeah.
And the Pulse nightclub was that first innate sense of, okay, A, I had been there myself on Latin night. We had Latin friends, and I knew the club layout, and it just resonated with me so much. And I'd never run a race in my life, and I just signed up to run with HRC to raise money, blah, blah, blah. But yeah, that was, I didn't tie it together at the time.
Well, it seems like you're continuing that work with your book and being so candid and being so vulnerable. And you also talk about how when you've, you know, gone to appearances for the book and done readings, and you talk about how people have come to you and mentioned what this book has meant to them to have this information out there. So can you talk a little bit about that?
I mean, I took a bath financially last year in this project, but it didn't, and I'm very fortunate that I was able to finance, the PR aspect and getting the word out. But then, as you see it, and it occurs multiple times where there was a mom of a Navy captain, an officer in the Navy had reached out and said, "Hey, thanks, because of you and your book, my son is able to live his life out and proud as a naval officer because you had the courage to tell your story." And it's like, wow, okay. That's not something it's amazing to get those type of stories. And last year I was at a leadership institute in Georgia, classroom full of other supervisory special agents. And these people know my profession inside and out. It was the most terrifying environment to get up and talk about my own vulnerabilities. Nobody knew that I'd written a book. It was starting to gain all the press. So I was like, okay, I have a blind spot in my leadership right now where nobody knows this other side of me. And I was like, okay, well, this is a leadership institute. That's what I'm here to do. And I got up and my Apple Watch showed my pulse had increased 60 beats per minute. I'm very, very nervous. And I just got up and I started talking about, this is terrifying for me, but I also have this other side hobby where I'm an author and it's gaining media attention, and this is my vulnerability. And I just openly talked about it in a room full of heterosexual, to my knowledge, I was the only LGBT member in there. And then later that night, somebody else in the class was like, "Hey, can we grab dinner?" So yeah, absolutely. And then she told me she had been in the profession for 18 years and was still closeted and still terrified of owning her identity. And we had an amazing dinner. We're now good friends. And so that was last July or August, I think. And so when that happens, it just affirms that this is what I need to be doing. This is what I should be doing. Period.
And it seems like in your chosen profession, there is some underlying machismo, like masculinity, maybe even toxic masculinity, although I don't know if I want to go that far. How were
Well,
you able?
it's called hyper masculine on the back of the book. That's
Okay, hyper
how it's
masculinity.
referred to, yeah.
How is probably a better word than toxic. How do you reconcile all of that in your career now, having come through everything that you came through, and then the writing of the book, and then supporting the community? How do you reconcile that in your career?
Ensuring I affect change. To ensure that this doesn't happen going forward within my own capabilities of, I perfected living two different lives. There was my professional life, there was my personal life, and that's how I survived, was by keeping them completely separate. And nobody knew I was, well, first I didn't know I was married to my then husband, but also the fear of discrimination, being fired. So just using that is the fuel going forward. And now in these roles where I can affect change, ensuring we are attracting diverse talent to bring into law enforcement to help undo some of that of the policies, and just trying to steer the ship where I can, and being the voice. And I've been granted the positions to do so. So just trying to change the tide little by little is the most I can do in advertising. And as we know in law enforcement, it is hyper masculine. And women make up like 10% of the workforce, LGBTQ. We're still a very, very small minority within that.
That you know of.
Right. And I had a Secret Service agent, supervisory, was like, "Hey," I reached out and he Googles himself every day to make sure he hasn't been outed.
Wow.
And I knew that because I'd done that myself. And this was last fall that he reached out. And I was like, man, okay, we still have a lot of work to do. And helping, like, I want to help stand up an LGBTQ organization for federal agents. There just one doesn't exist. It hasn't been done yet. And so people know that, hey, there's somebody I can call and ask, is this discrimination? Am I, being retaliated against? And so that's my hope as well going forward, that I can help with some of that.
Well, on page 118 in the book, you describe your own discrimination and you say, "I wasn't sure what to do with the information. I still didn't have career status, so I didn't have enough clout to lodge a formal complaint and be successful. It might have meant risking my career. I chose to keep my mouth shut." I think we see this all the time. People mm-hmm. say, why don't, you know, rape victims, why don't they tell? Why don't you go forward? I just wanted to highlight that. I don't really have a question around it, but I just thought it was so important for people to understand. This is why people don't come forward. They don't feel they can.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Even though the law should protect us, it doesn't.
No, it doesn't.
No, because of work. I'm sorry, go ahead. Work up.
No, I was just agreeing that no, it doesn't. And there's so many situations where people feel wronged or grieved or something in whatever their job is, whether it's because of race or gender or sexual orientation or anything, but they feel like they can't do anything about it. And I mean, I've been in situations where I'm like, nope, can't go to HR about this because they're not really there to protect me. So I can't imagine how difficult it must be to, I mean, I can't hide that I'm a woman. I can't hide that I'm Black, you know, so I can't live that much of a double life, right? So I can't imagine the stress that puts on people to have to live that, or to feel, well, not just to feel, but to know that they have to live that way.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. These cultures exist mm-hmm. in any I don't want to say any, there's a whole lot of great stuff out there. But we know, and I'll never know what you all deal with as women or minority women of sexual harassment. I mean, any number of things, as you said, that I will never deal with because I'm a white male. And that privilege has gotten me far in my career because, like you said, I was able to separate. Mm-hmm. I'm not really effeminate, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Regardless, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was able to separate those things to achieve my professional goals while swallowing my own personal life. But that was a privilege that I had that a lot of people don't. So again, it's up to us to, if we're in a position to affect change, and we have to be doing that and making sure that we flag things as early as we can. I operate with transparency in my role. And so people know, hey, this is what we want. This is the decisions we're making. This is why. Please come to me if something's going on, or mm-hmm. they know that they can candidly talk to me without fear of retribution or any kind of impact to their career. Unless there's something ethically or, you know, there's those situations that we can't control. But yeah, it sucks. And I only know a fraction of that environment that many others deal with very regularly.
Is it getting any better?
I think so, but that's only through the lens of my experience.
Right. But I mean, specifically in Secret Service, have you seen... Because, I mean, this is a world, I mean, aside from reading your book, I have no experience with that world at all. So is it getting any better?
I didn't get that. Could you try again?
I heard that, though.
I have no idea why that happened. I'm so sorry. We'll just cut that out.
It was fun.
Okay. Yeah.
Glad she's listening. Yeah, it is. And the... No, I can't speak for the Secret Service. I left the agency. It'll be 5 years next month.
Okay.
I have a lot of close friends, and you know, we became family through the years. But they now have a female director. So yeah, there are positive changes occurring, and you know, as I look forward and ensuring that we promote minorities and women into these roles to again give them the power to affect the changes, and their perspectives and their views are desperately needed to help us make these decisions and guide us to make sure we're looking at things in a holistic manner. So yeah, but that, again, that's my experience, and I work for a great agency. So I'm very fortunate that it is warm and welcome. But I can't speak for other agencies where that's still that hyper-masculine.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah, overall, yes, I think we are making progress.
Okay.
I have a burning, burning question, and I don't even know how much you can talk about it, but.
Oh, I think I know what you're going to ask.
I am very curious, while you were in the Secret Service, how did the Trump presidency either change you or restrict you, or how did it affect your life as a gay Secret Service man?
So I left the Secret Service in April of 2019. So I was still assigned to the Obamas at that time.
Oh, thank God for you.
And I was due to be reassigned to the Trumps in November of 2019. And I worked, it was, I don't speak for the agency. No, I've said that before. It
Of course.
was alarming to see the, you know, to see the Obamas come out of office. And, you know, I was a site agent for Trump's inaugural ball at Union Station. And like, that was one of the most stressful things. And the very next morning, I had to put on a different hat and I reverted back to the Obamas. And so I was waiting out at Joint Base Andrews as Marine One lifts off from the US Capitol and it lands at Andrews and the Obamas get on Air Force One, and then take off for the final time. It was surreal to witness history as it's occurring. And I was also green with envy because all my peers got on Air Force One and flew off to California. And I was not able to go on that trip because I was assigned to the Obama daughters for a trip the very next morning. So I was green with envy. I didn't get to fly out on Air Force One out to California. But yeah, it was a lot of it was surreal. And as we dealt with the attacks on our community, LGBTQ, but that was only the beginning of that. And I had no idea that it would get way, way worse as it has. And this is now 2024. That the attacks would continue. And like last year, the ACLU had over 500 bills that they were tracking across the country of anti-LGBTQ. And to see that just continue to occur. And as we saw in Alabama a month or so ago, IVF rights are under attack, which we are dealing with ourselves, and the implications of this rhetoric of the Republicans trying to change. Again, so it's alarming, but we also use that as fuel to stand up, speak loudly, and help others along the way, and ensure that our voices are heard to try and put a stop to this type of
Madness
yeah,
to this madness.
Yes.
Utter madness.
It's just it's nuts. It's very upsetting. It's very upsetting. So we're talking about IVF, and you've mentioned on Instagram and some other things about the journey that you and your family are going through with surrogacy and starting a family and having kids and the whole thing. Can you talk about that? I mean, I know all this shit with like people trying to pass laws to restrict your ability to have a family. We'll get to that, but can we just start with that this is a happy, happy thing for you and your family?
Absolutely. Are you kidding me? I'd love to talk about this.
Awesome.
Yeah, actually, there's a picture, a 3D ultrasound of our sooning our new arrival son, who's coming in
Yay!
about 10 weeks.
Congratulations. Oh, 10
10 weeks.
Ooh,
Yeah, we're in our
happy.
third trimester, so we've got our wedding is in 6 or 7 weeks.
Oh,
The baby is a
congratulations.
few weeks after that. We've got a trip to Japan in there. We're doing like a honey baby moon, like because we can't travel in May due to the baby coming. Yeah, it has been in May. It'll be 3 years that we started this process. Of course, during the pandemic, we attended our first Men Having Babies conference virtually, and then that kicked off our plan. Was like, okay, how we knew we both wanted children. We knew that from the moment we met that we had these larger aspirations and our life goals aligned. And I've been through the adoption process with my ex. So like, okay, surrogacy is our way forward. It has been a wild ride that, oh my God, has cost so, so much. There's been obstacles where we had a swap out a surrogate due to issues with her, which gave us a 16-month setback. But yeah, we finally, once we replaced that surrogate and had a successful embryo transfer in September. And that's the baby that's due in a few weeks, not a few weeks, 10 weeks. So yeah, it has been a great, a really long journey, an expensive journey, but it's almost, I'm sorry, I keep looking at his picture. It's right behind the computer screen. Yeah, and when we go down for ultrasounds, I still get emotional when I'll see like the flashes of the orange and blue of the blood flow as they're doing the ultrasound to make sure his heart is good, healthy, and development is happening, that I'm going to be a hot mess. Because I will tear up just watching the ultrasound of like, okay, this has actually happened. Like, I'm older. I'm going to be an older parent, and to have had to wait so long due to obstacles or whatever it is it's amazing. And we can't wait. As I count down the weeks, we have a countdown thing out there on the TV stand. It's like, okay, we only have like 10 or 11 more weekends of like sleeping in. We better. Yeah, it's amazing. And we absolutely can't wait for the joys that lie ahead. We're babysitting our friends' kids, just trying to like get the experience. Not that I don't know how to like babysit kids, but yeah, we absolutely can't wait. It's been quite the journey.
Sleeping in is so overrated.
I wake up late anyway.
Yeah, I am not an early bird, so just go ahead and relish the time that you have left to sleep in. I mean, I don't know this from personal experience because I don't have kids, but I hear people talk about it. So enjoy your sleep now.
Well, I will say this. I lost my first baby. And so when my second child was born, and I think you might find this similar, in the night when she woke me up, I relished every moment of it because it was such a hard won baby. And I enjoyed, I filmed her at night. I changed her clothes 17 times, took pictures. I did all that in the middle of the night and loved every second of it. So just love every second of it.
Yeah. There's, like you said, there's beauty in it because we will know, you know, we went through failed transfers and pregnancy tests. And then, you know, it so I can go into many different rabbit holes with that. But
oh,
we
yeah.
don't talk about that enough. And mm-hmm. you all, women aren't, and I heard it from my publicist of like, miscarriage happens all the time, but yet we yeah. aren't openly talking about the effects of that. And we weren't, of course, carrying the embryos or the foetus. But to know the loss that comes with that and your emotional toll, mm-hmm. I underestimated all of it.
It yeah. still hurts, doesn't it?
There were like breakdown moments of like, can we keep doing this? I can't, like, because you, through those 10 weeks or however long you had the pregnancy, your mind goes to amazing places of being parents and like, okay, this is what my daughter's going to look like. This is what, and then to just have that ripped away. And we don't talk about it, and we should be,
no,
as a society, discussing those things that we, again, they all relate. We can all relate to that stuff. And anyways, yes, we're super excited, but those, more that we could do there to help other people in processing some of the grief that comes with carriages and such.
The interesting thing, my niece and her wife are going through the IVF process right now as well. And they had an embryo that attached. And then right before Christmas, for whatever reason, their baby didn't survive. And she and I have talked about this a lot about the grief process is real. You are grieving a dream. You are grieving a baby. And I just really think it's so important to get that information out there because I've always heard people talk about, oh, we don't tell anyone we're pregnant until we're 16 weeks in so that, you know, so that we don't have to untell people. But then people right. don't know you're grieving. Mm-hmm. No one knows you're even going through something.
And yeah, it's... Go ahead.
No, you tell me.
It's, and we fall into that camp and, you know, my fiance is a physician and very cautionary, info because he knows way, way more about human biology and the processes and like, okay, at this ultrasound after 12 weeks, this is our risk rate. This is our, you know, so we know a lot of information. He does way more than me, but you're right. We didn't tell anybody, and we told our close family that we were pregnant. And but like you said, when we had those failures, nobody knew. Mm. And it was just Johnny and I, and you know, I broke down crying. It's just, again, I underestimated the emotional toll of it. And friends of ours, they just had an embryo transfer. Actually, two friends of ours had embryo transfers last week, and they posted it all on Insta. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I could do that. And we never did because of that. Exactly what you just said. We
yeah.
were a bit afraid to put the info out there of then having to tell everybody.
And then you have to pull it back. And then, but then my side, and my niece and I have talked about this a lot because she's in your camp. She's like, we're not telling anybody anything because we don't want to have to untell. And I'm like, but then who grieves with you? You're alone.
Mm-hmm.
And all of this thing, and it doesn't matter which way you do it, there's no right or wrong, but we need to talk about it so that people know.
It's this weird social environment. Yes. And that I get we're literally discussing right now that we don't know how to like wave our way. What's the proper decision?
Yeah.
I don't think there is a proper decision.
Right. Right. Like what you said, Jennifer, I think it's everybody has to make that decision for themselves.
Yes.
And I wish that, like you guys are saying, I wish there wasn't that societal expectation that you don't tell. I just wish it was just like, you know what? You make the decision for you. If you want to tell, great. If you want to wait to tell, great. If you want to just start out with sharing every detail, okay, fine. That you do you, right?
Yeah. And then when I saw my friend's post about, they posted a picture of the embryo hatching and all that stuff. And I was like, man, my mind went to the thoughts of it would really, really suck to have to, as you said, go back and have to reel that all back in instead of finding the beauty in these moments. And it robs us of that joy of sharing the pleasures of each of those milestones of the embryo transfer to, you know, your 5 or 6 week ultrasound where you get the heartbeat to confirmation second, you know, it robs us of the ability to express
the beautiful moments.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Until like we're 3 months in.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned briefly being an older dad. Your life leading up to where you are now, I mean, you were working so hard. Your job was all consuming. You were still figuring out who you were, right? And how to live your life authentically and not have to live two separate lives. Part of me feels like this is the right time for you. You know, I mean, who cares if you're an older dad? I mean, it's not like you're like 88 years old. I mean,
plus you're in great shape.
Yeah, you're incredibly fit. I mean, reading this, yeah. I'm like, good Lord. I mean, I don't think you're going to have any joy. I kind of feel like, you know what?
That's one lucky kid, man.
Right, dude, you're at the best place in your life to be a dad right now. And you can spend all the time and I don't know. I don't worry about, I mean, not that my opinion matters, but I don't worry about you being an older dad. I think you're at a great place to be a dad.
Yeah, that's another one of those societal expectations that trying to break free from is everybody expects you to come out of high school, go to college, get a job, get married, have kids, pop everything out by 30, good to go. Whereas it fails to take into account reality. And like all of our roadmaps are different and we do all kinds of stuff individually. So yeah, Raquel, I absolutely agree with you. I think it's just that societal constant voice in your ear that is telling you, hey, and all my siblings, I am the last one of all my siblings to have children. So we're going to have, mom already has 9 grandkids. So these are going to be her final two. So yeah, it's just that constant voice that we hear from others that we need to learn to tune out. And Jennifer, as you pointed out, it's being able to recognize everything we've learned and that's going to make us amazing parents. And who cares if I'm only 28 right now, older in life. That's a joke. I'm 28.
But you're only 27.
Yeah. We're going.
Me too.
But
as long as we're going there, me too.
Sure.
And to know and not be married, you know, I'm on social media a lot for the author, the book stuff, the writing stuff, but we were babysitting our friend's kids on Thursday and I was holding the 8-month-old and feeding, giving her a bottle and just to be fully immersed in her. And as she's like grasping the bottle and just these tiny, adorable little hands and just big, beautiful eyes. And just to be in those moments, and that wasn't even our child, of being able to recognize just the beauty of that. And hopefully I'd jump out of bed with a spring in my step at 2 a.m. to feed the baby.
I just bet you might.
Hopefully. Well, we waited a long time for this, so I don't think.
Exactly.
And we both worked an insane amount of overnight shifts and 24s and 16s or whatever. So I think we're well adjusted for the changes that are coming soon.
Yeah. Could you now talk about the politics of IVF and tell our listeners what's happening out there in the world and why it's important that we pay attention and that we vote and that we take action, protest if possible. Tell us what's going on in the politics of IVF.
Ooh. I mean, the Republican Party largely is the Trump Party. And I think they've taken over the RNC with his daughter-in-law now, like the co-chair. So they're going to be funneling funds to whatever. So yeah, they've taken, as we saw with the overturn of Roe v. Wade, that was just the start of what they aspire to do. And they've shown their hand.
Oh, yeah. They've been very open about it.
They're no longer veiling their attempts that Justice Alito has mentioned more than once about overturning gay marriage. Mm-hmm. And as we saw in Alabama, the Supreme Court there, and now they're trying to backtrack. They're like, oh, well, we didn't mean to do that. Were they out? You know, you couldn't have IVF in the state of Alabama. And I think the governor now signed into law that you can. But there's others in the Republican Party who are like, yeah, no, we're not going to be protecting IVF. There's been votes on Capitol Hill to protect IVF across the board, and they have tanked it. Republicans have. So they may say they are okay with IVF, but their actions are not matching their words. Yeah. And that has far-reaching implications, not only for us, but there's so many people who are infertile or they're dealing with issues at our core. Most of us aspire to have children and pass on our legacies. And it's a very humanistic desire for a lot of us. That at the end of the day, that's what we hope for. And to rob people of that, it is absolutely awful. And it's the people who need access to reproductive healthcare choices that are affected the most. Because, you know, there's those of us who are privileged that we can go somewhere else, or we live in California where we're protected, we have great clinics. But then once you outlaw IVF, what are those physicians doing? Professional, they're also going to leave the state. All these related entities, these professionals, the surrogacy agencies, all that comes into play. And now there's this vacuum in Alabama, per se, where people who need IVF the most no longer have access. They may have saved up for a decade to have children via IVF, and their employer also may not provide coverage, like the federal government doesn't. There's just so many implications to all of that. And that's not even taking into account the legal aspects of, we're told we have to legally adopt our children once they're born, despite us both being on the birth certificates. Because if the Republicans get in control and they decide that, hey, two people of the same sex cannot be on the birth certificate or be the legal guardians of children, we have to legally adopt them as a secondary protection.
Oh, wow. Didn't know that.
Because obviously only one of us is biologically related to the child, and the other one is left flapping in the wind. Even though we're married, well, we're about to be married. So there's so many spider webs, if you will, that sprawl out.
It's so far reaching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh, it's a fucking shame. I absolutely hate it that you and your family and other people similarly situated have to jump through so many hoops and have to think so broadly about the decision to grow their family that it's not just, hey, we're having a baby, we're growing our family. No, you have to think about all this other shit that hetero couples don't have to think about. And I hate it. I hate it. I hate it for you. I hate it for everybody else. It fucking sucks. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah. And this, the other aspect, is the discrimination that exists in the definitions of infertility. Mm-hmm. So I work for the largest employer in the United States, and we have no IVF coverage, no surrogacy benefits, no nothing. My fiance works for the largest healthcare company in California. Nothing based on the definition of infertility, because we as two men, we're not infertile. And we're like, I'm sorry. By our very virtue of being two men, we are
infertile. Yeah.
But no, it's hundreds of thousands of dollars out of pocket for us to try and grow our family. And so because the lobbyists are so powerful for the healthcare companies, health insurance companies, that it's all based on that legislative definition. And there are states like Illinois and New York who are making progress, but are ruling, hey, no, you will provide coverage to same-sex couples. And so progress is slow, and I'm really surprised that California has not, that has not happened here yet, but I can only imagine it's based on the lobbyists in Sacramento who are holding the reins and donating enough money that it's holding, withholding that from us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it just goes to show that the personal is absolutely political in the world that we live in. And there's just, there's really no way around that.
Yeah.
Yelling, just keep yelling and screaming about it, I guess.
Yes. Yes.
And vote. And vote.
Yes. And vote. Yes.
Every election.
Use your voice. Use your voice. Use
every
your vote.
Every primary. Yeah. Local elections, you better get out and vote and ensure that this, I don't have enough adjectives to describe if Trump were to be reelected, then our democracy is no longer in existence. We're done. We're flushing it, and just the just how important it is for everybody to get out and vote.
I saw this morning when I woke up that Trump is now leading in Michigan again.
Oh, God.
I live in Michigan. I'm like, boy. Not that that matters. Michigan is an important state in this election. So anyway.
I don't put a whole lot of weight in the polls anymore, because if they're only what, and I took statistics in grad school and was like, okay, well, let me see the data pool. Let me see. Okay, you did 910 people via landline phone in.
Most of us don't pick up the phone anymore.
Well, hey, no, not many of us have a landline phone.
I don't.
Yeah, nope.
Right, we haven't for years. So what is your polling data? And you look at the fundraising of the Biden campaign, announced they raised $53 million in February alone. And in the 3 hours surrounding the State of Union, those were their largest fundraising hours ever following this. Surrounding the State of the Union. So the power is there. So I don't put a whole lot of weight in the polls. As we saw in 2016, the polls were way wrong.
Yeah.
Okay, you give me a little hope, a little hope.
Yeah, I don't put too much into that.
So I feel like we could talk to you forever and ever, but we are kind of running out of time. What didn't we ask you about that you want to let our audience know, either about yourself or the book, or... Tell us, what's your message?
Be yourself. Find people to help you along. And if somebody doesn't bring you joy, isn't helping you achieve your goals, personal, professional, like, surround yourself with the people who are going to help you. I don't know if that came across right.
It came across good. Tell us more.
I love it.
Be authentic, be candid, have more face-to-face interactions with people. And even as I saw when I'm from Western PA and that's Trump country, and I go back and I put down my phone and I have interactions with people, we all relate. We have way more in common than we do not. Mm-hmm. So when I get back and I get in front of people and I talk about the stuff we're dealing with, our struggles, people relate to that, even if they were previous Trump voters or whatever. I'm not out here trying to change everybody's vote. I would love to do that. But that's the stuff we all relate to. And there's a lot of power in just being authentic and vulnerable. And if you can't change the people around you, change your situation when you can, but hang in there. And especially for the LGBTQ youth, you are needed. You are loved. You are perfect the way you are. There's a lot of great organizations out there like the Trevor Project, ACLU, HRC, like reach out for help, find your voice, send a DM to somebody. Like if you need help, please know that there's help out there, and we're one collective great society and we're going in the right direction together. I know that sounds cliche.
No, I love it. That's a beautiful message, Corey. Thank you so much. And thank you for writing this book and putting all of the time and the effort and the vulnerability into writing this book and getting it out in the world and helping to spread your message. And thank you for letting us be part of helping to get your message out. This is very important, and it's such a good book. Thank you.
Oh, thank you both, Jennifer and Raquel. It's been fantastic to be on. And thank you for the work that you do to put people's voices out there and to help show the stories that will help other people. So thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
Thank you, Corey.
Oh, recap, Raquel. What a great discussion.
It was such a joy to meet Corey and to read his book and to hear him talk about the effect that the book has had on him, not just writing the book and, you know, the catharsis of getting those feelings out and reflecting on the experiences, but then the reactions that he's getting from other people, and for people to know that this book is out there, that they aren't alone, that their journey can be, there's so much more to our journeys than where we are at that moment. And to know that, yes, things get tough, but like Corey said at the end, things do get better. And there are people that out there who are your people. There are people who will support you.
I think of all the little Corys that are out there, the little beautiful boys in their homes, in their bedrooms, in their school systems that maybe are being supported or aren't being supported or don't know who to talk to or where to turn. And then they maybe get a glimpse of this book or see him on TikTok or read one of his stories on Medium, and their life has changed forever because they can see themselves as a grown-up man with a spouse and a career and a baby on the way. And they know that it's possible.
Yeah.
Because Corey did it, they can do it too.
Yeah.
What a beautiful story. I really liked the book a lot. And yeah. I encourage our listeners to check him out on TikTok. Really great shorts about kind of what's happened politically and with IVF. Mm-hmm. And then the stories on Medium about little short snippets of a life. And I think it's beautiful.
Yeah. And on Instagram, I mean, he's very vulnerable on Instagram, and there's the picture of the sonogram on Instagram, and just hearing about his journey and how it's developed and the work that he continues to do. And I'm so excited to see where this all goes. And I'm so excited for his growing family. And I mean, it's beautiful, and there's so much hope in it.
And I want to make a special request of our listeners. If you could please share this episode and tell people about IVF and why it's important and why we need to protect it. And the IVF issue is not some, you know, small issue that affects a few people in the world. Thousands and thousands and thousands of people, even heterosexual couples need IVF. Mm-hmm. Same-sex couples need IVF.
Single parents who want to have babies.
Yes, exactly.
You know, or people who, you know, and broaden that to surrogacy. I mean, if someone for whatever reason doesn't have the ability to carry or birth or produce an egg or produce a sperm, whatever, if these people want to be parents, they should continue to have the right and the ability to do so.
Yes. So please share the episode. Please talk about it. Please vote. Please read Corey's book.
Yeah.
Breaking Free. It's so good.
It's so good. And it's not a downer book. Like I said, there's a lot of hope in the story, and there's humor in there. I mean, I hope people can tell from just our little bit of time with Corey that he's incredibly personable and interesting, and all that comes through in the book. So read the book, share the book with friends, share this episode with friends, share it with anybody you know
who has a vote
who has a vote and who needs or just wants this message, just share it with everybody. It's great.
And vote.
And vote, yes. Thanks everyone for listening today. We will be back with more Madness Cafe next week. You can find us on Instagram at Madness Cafe Podcast or email us at madnesscafepodcast@gmail.com. Bye.